So extinction doesn't actually eliminate prior learning. We're sort of good with that idea at this point. Sometimes our extinguished response actually comes back, much like cats. You take the cat someplace, and the cat comes back. Just won't stay away. And sometimes that's good. Sometimes it's not. For behavioral therapy, having your extinguished response come back would be not good. Which would be, I guess we could say, bad. Because that's what we're trying to stop. A behavior there. So we'd like it to stay extinguished. So is there anything we can do to actually enhance the extinction process? You know, bump it up a notch. Well, a couple of obvious things. The first one is just give more extinction trials. So keep going. It's like, yeah, it's been nicely reduced. You're not doing it much anymore. Just keep doing some more extinction trials. Okay, seems to be extinguished. Do some more. It's kind of like, well, it's overlearning, really. We've talked about overlearning. Once you go through an acquisition phase and you have a, you know, the strongest conditional response you can have, you could just stop right then, or you could keep doing some more acquisition trials. Well, since we're talking about extinction as essentially the acquisition of an inhibitory structure, then even once we fully extinguish the response, if we do more extinction trials, essentially more acquisition trials of an inhibitory process, we should have a stronger extinction. And in fact, we do. So if you've got the time, the wherewithal, the abilities, just keep running extinction trials. How will I know it's working? I'm not getting any response. Yeah, well, you won't know it's working unless you try looking for things like, you know, renewal or reinstatement or spontaneous recovery or things like that. Just, you know, kind of got to trust me on this one. The more extinction trials you do, the more effective the extinction is going to be. Second thing you can do is play around with the timing of this. So work with aversive conditioning protocols have shown that by spacing extinction trials closer together, doing what's called massed presentations, rather than spreading them out, or what's called spaced format, seems to make the extinction process more effective. We don't really have a lot of data with respect to differences between massed or spaced extinction procedures in appetitive conditioning yet. Again, most of the focus has been on things where you're trying to extinguish aversive control for therapy, but so we don't really know at this point what's going on. So, you know, graduate school topic for somebody right there. Okay, so what else can we do? Well, we might get into some problems with spontaneous recovery. Time passes, you re-encounter the stimulus, and to make the response, how can we reduce that? Well, to reduce spontaneous recovery, you can do repeated periods of rest and test. So you complete your extinction, you wait for some time, you present the stimulus, so you wait for some time, you rest. You present the stimulus, you test, you get a spontaneous recovery. The more often you do this, the weaker and weaker and weaker that recovery is every time. So just do more rest and test in that sense. Each cycle reduces the magnitude of the recovered spontaneous response. You can also manipulate the interval between the acquisition and extinction period. However, there's some ambiguities about exactly what this will do in all circumstances. In studies that have focused on fear conditioning, it's been found that there's less spontaneous recovery if the period between extinction and testing is shorter. So if it's a period of less than a day versus, say, 6 or 7 days. However, some studies of appetitive conditioning found the opposite. In that case, there's actually more spontaneous recovery if the interval between extinction and testing is shorter rather than longer. And it's unclear at this point why there is that difference. I think there's only been a few studies that have actually looked at this, looked at playing around with the interval, and they've all used radically different methodological designs between studies versus within studies, different species, fear versus appetitive conditioning. So, again, there's just not a lot. This is the kind of stuff that's been going on over the last, 3 years. Okay, so, as I said, there's, a lot of stuff happening research-wise. You might think, gee, we've known about extinction for, in comparative psychology, the last, roughly 105 years. What else is there to do? Well, actually a fair amount, especially when you start looking at it in terms of applied contexts. The other thing you can try to reduce spontaneous recovery is actually make sure that you present the cues that have been associated with extinction. Right? So in essence, if you can present the discriminative stimuli that goes along with extinction, that you were using during extinction, this actually enhances the extinction. It's like, oh yeah, I'm on that three-term contingency. I'm not on the acquisition. Now, it's interesting that the acquisition stimuli do seem to form stronger associations for your initial excitatory conditioning. So acquisition of excitatory stimuli seems to produce a stronger association as opposed to the inhibitory structure. And again, it's unclear exactly why that is. We don't know if that's something dealing with underlying nervous system differences between excitatory and inhibitory activation of neuronal systems. We don't really know what the reason is for that. It's just one of those things that one has to sort of deal with. But there's more theory that's going to be coming out in that direction as well. Okay. In terms of reducing renewal, we could, and talked about this in terms of the therapy of doing your behavioral therapy in multiple settings, conduct your extinction training in different settings. So basically what this does is it increases your stimulus generalization. Okay, so it generalizes your stimulus control that's associated with the inhibitory extinction component. You can also present, again, the discriminative stimuli for extinction during the renewal process as well. So it's like, oh yeah, here's the extinction SDs. You should be thinking extinction here. I think your textbook mentions a little study where there's people that had fears of spiders, spider phobia, and even if they're in a different setting, they were suggested mentally rehearse what happened. Imagine you were back in the therapeutic setting and mentally think about the therapeutic setting, thereby at least mentally activating the discriminative stimuli from which during the extinction process. And it seemed to reduce, in those cases, the phobic response to spiders in different contexts. So that could perhaps be a technique as well that could be applied more in behavioral modification settings. We can also do some rather esoteric things. We can do what's called compound extinction stimuli sets. So we can actually present multiple, two or more, stimuli together that are undergoing extinction, so present them simultaneously. Rescorla did this. Perhaps he just keeps doing stuff, even though he's, been working for 50-odd years here. So in 2006, Rescorla reported on a study with rats. They had three stimuli, a light and two auditory stimuli. So a visual stimuli and two auditory. So light, noise, and tone. Conditioned the rats to acquire a lever-pressing response on a VI 30-second schedule in the presence of the various stimuli. So in the presence of a light or a tone or a noise, So any of these stimuli, if you press the lever, you're going to get reinforced in the VI-30. Okay? Then extinguishes all the stimuli. So now, doesn't matter in the presence of the light, or in the presence of the tone, or in the presence of the noise, if you respond, oh, sorry, so sad, too bad, you get nothing. Oh, sad rats. And then he shifts into what's called a compound extinction phase. So he pairs, essentially it's a second extinction phase. So we've already extinguished the stimuli individually. Then he takes and does more extinction trials with the light and, again, counterbalances in different groups of rats, and one of the two auditory stimuli. Okay, so he takes one of the two auditory stimuli, pairs it up with the light, and does more extinction trials. And does more extinction trials of just the other auditory stimuli by itself. And he gets this. So the yellow circle is our light. So here's our initial extinction process. Okay, and that's sort of the amount of responding that we have. So they're fairly extinguished. Back during, I didn't put it on the graph, but back prior to extinction, they're responding up towards the top of what this would be on the graph here. So we've got relatively little responding down here. Then we go through a compound extinction phase, and the blue square is our second auditory stimulus, whether it's the noise or the tone. Again, it depends on the counterbalance group you're in. And the green triangle is the light and our auditory, our first auditory stimulus, so the other auditory. So there's our compound extinction. And then we test our auditory stimuli, and what we find is that we've got much more responding to our second auditory stimulus, the stimulus that was went through its second batch of extinction just by itself. So, looking at this here, this elevator responding, what this is representing is it's called the summation of the sub-threshold responding that remains to our light and one of our auditory stimuli. So, notice we haven't completely extinguished our responding down here. There's still some responding. We just can't really pick it up. But we put them together in a different context. So it's like, oh, now you're doing a compound stimulus. Well, that's a little bit different. It's like, oh, yeah. And there's, again, it's showing we haven't completely extinguished these when we did them individually. Over here, we get a substantial spontaneous recovery of A2, and we get very little. Oops, come back here. And we get really no recovery of A1. So in other words, this second compound phase really puts the kibosh on responding with respect to our auditory stimuli that was presented in compound. This seems to be a very effective way of eliminating, a very effective way of enhancing the extinction process. Okay, so what are we actually learning then in extinction? What are we really acquiring? Well, we know that our SO and RO associations don't get eliminated. What seems to be happening is perhaps we're acquiring inhibitory stimulus response associations. We know from things that we've discussed here today, and even just by sort of common sense, real world thinking about stuff, extinction effects are very specific, and they're highly specific to the context in which a response was actually extinguished in. So, for example, if you never received birthday presents on your birthday as a kid, as an adult, you're not really going to miss getting any birthday presents if you don't get any on your birthday. The flip side of that is, if you haven't had birthday presents, if you didn't get birthday presents as a kid on your birthday, getting birthday presents on your birthday as an adult can be pretty darn exciting, which is fun with my wife because they never celebrated birthdays in her family when she was a kid, so I get to score Mondo husband points by getting her gifts on her birthday. It works very nicely. same deal with Christmas and things like that. So, anyhow, Rescorla. Again, this is like the day of Rescorla. Okay, so. Did I mention he's my academic grandfather? My advisor was his student, so I'm essentially his PhD grandchild. But, you know, he's like, he never writes. He never sends me anything on my birthday or, you know, my PhD anniversary, anything like that. It's, we do not have a close relationship. It's quite tragic. All choked up. Anyhow, 93 study by Rescorla. Use discrimination training, nose poke that we talked about before. So nose poke leads to food whenever either a light or a noise is present. Doesn't really matter which. If there's light, if there's noise, if you poke your nose into a hole, you can get some food. Second phase, lever press and or chain pull. So you can either lever press or chain pull. You don't have to do them at the same time. Either one or the other. So response one, response two. And doing either of those responses will give you some food as well. Now, notice we don't have a stimulus response association between either our light or our noise and our responses. Okay, in phase two here, light and noise aren't being presented. That was back in phase one. In the presence of light or noise, if you poke your nose into a hole, you get some food. Phase two, there's a lever there and there's a chain hangling. I wanted to say either hanging or dangling. So I got hangling. So you got a chain that's hangling. I'm going to just keep using that word, and people will perhaps think that it's actually a scientific term that we use in the literature. So we got a hangling chain. And those are two responses. But there's neither of these two stimuli. Now, I mean, there's going to be other context cues, context stimuli, but we're really concerned with these sort of obvious ones here. All right. Then, in phase three, they did something rather interesting. In the presence of the noise, if the first response is made, extinction. Won't get reinforced. And in the presence of the light, second response will not lead to reinforcement. So this sets up some very specific stimulus-response SR associations there. It's not just in the presence of any stimuli, everything's extinguished. No response will work. It's noise, response one, so let's say lever press, and light, response two. Okay. So we've now got these specific SR inhibitory associations, and then we test. So now we turn on the noise, and our rats have a choice. They can either make response one or response two. And we turn on the light. What are they going to pick? Response one or response two? Well, in this case here, since the noise was associated with the extinction of response one, the rats preferentially respond to the second response. And in the presence of the light, the second response was extinguished. And in this case down here, in the presence of the light, they respond more on R1. They suppress their R2 responding, respond more on R1. So what do we got? Well, we can't explain this with either stimulus outcome or response outcome effects. Okay, because at no point did we actually pair the stimuli, our noise and light, directly with an outcome situation. And our response outcome, well, you can still get the food just with different responses. So this doesn't work. All we really got left to work with here is our stimulus response. So in the presence of the stimulus, one response isn't going to work. In the presence of the other stimulus, a different response isn't going to work. So, again, so this suggests that what we're dealing with in extinction is a stimulus-response association. Now, if we think back to our discussion of central emotional states, we were talking about how classical conditioning of mood states can affect operant responding. This is back with the, you know, if you're afraid, you maybe suppress a response in one situation, but if you have a CS minus, that indicates that you're not going to get the aversive, this makes you hopeful or relieved, and so you respond more. Okay, so we've got something, you know, kind of comparable there. Now, back when we were talking about central emotional states, we were talking about this stimulus response, this SR association that was coming through with the classical conditioning. So when we have our decline in responding in an extinction situation, as we've said earlier, this gets linked into frustration because you're not getting what you expected. So the frustration is kind of like inducing this central emotional state, if you will. It goes back to this SR association. Now, the interesting thing about this is you get some kind of weird effects coming out of this. Some of them seem extremely counterintuitive, for which they are often called the paradoxical effects of extinction. So overtraining. So the more acquisition trials you have, the greater the expectancy of reward. So excitatory acquisition. Okay. So we do our initial training here. So the more you've trained, the more you expect to get the reward. And consequently, when we shift you to extinction, the greater the frustration. You've got such a strong expectation, you get a lot of frustration. But here's the odd, is you go, okay, so what's the weird part? The weird part is, the more you've been trained, the more rapidly you extinguish. You'd expect, perhaps, the opposite. The more you've trained, the stronger a response you should have, which should perhaps be more resistant to extinction. But we don't get that. Actually, the more you've trained, the easier it is to extinguish that. The more, perhaps, aware you are. It's like, in the presence of these particular stimuli set, stimulus cue, discriminative stimulus, if I make this response, I am going to get this outcome. Holy crud, I didn't. Well, there's something really wrong here. As opposed to and you get very frustrated. It's like, I am very frustrated with this. It's telling me there's something very wrong. The system's not working. As opposed to, you started training, haven't had that many trials, perhaps I'm not entirely clear on the associations involved, so I do stuff, and sometimes I get reinforced. That's sweet. I don't entirely, I'm not getting reinforced. Huh. I wonder, maybe I just have to try a different response or something. Maybe I'm not doing it right. Maybe it wasn't quite what I thought it was. I'll try something else for a little while. Okay? So it's weird in this sense. It seems a bit odd when you just look at it. You'd think the more training you have, the more resistant you should be, but that's not actually the case. Magnitude of the reinforcement extinction effect. You get more rapid extinction if you've trained with a larger rather than a smaller magnitude reinforcer. And again, you would think if you're used to getting something really small, it's like, oh, well, I'm not getting it anymore. Big deal. I'm going to stop. But in fact, you stop more rapidly. The extinction is more rapid if you've been used to getting a large reinforcer. And again, it seems that the expectancy of having a greater reward when you don't get that reward produces more frustration. So you get a much stronger SR effect there. Partial reinforcement extinction effect, or the PRE effect. Continuous reinforcement, CRF. It's the same thing as fixed ratio 1. Okay? So continuous reinforcement is a fixed ratio 1 schedule. Every time you respond, you get reinforced. Every single time. Anything else, any other schedule, is going to be intermittent reinforcement, or what you can call partial reinforcement. Anything at all. FR2, obviously. Any of the interval schedules? I mean, you might say, well, what about a fixed interval 1 second? It's like, yeah, if you respond at half a second and you don't get anything, then one of your responses was not reinforced. Okay, what about a fixed interval half a second? Okay, if you respond at a quarter of a second and you don't get something, then, okay, what about a fixed interval 2 microseconds? Yeah, okay, well, then if you respond at 1 microsecond, okay, it gets ludicrous at some point, okay? So, yes, obviously, when we're dealing with very small time intervals, fine. Practically speaking, a really small time interval may have the same effect as CRF. But in principle, in theory, right? Do you get the idea on this one? Why do I seem to keep hammering this? Because it seems that no matter how much I do, people in 281 just don't quite get it. So I'll come back to it here. What we find is that extinction is much more rapid on a CRF. Okay. The less likely each response is of being reinforced, the more difficult it's going to be to extinguish. So a variable ratio 6009 schedule, which would be pretty silly. I think the highest VR schedule I've ever seen reported was something like about a VR 700, something like that. You can get rats to do an amazing amount of work, right? But it's not like they're going anywhere. It's like, yep, just here in my upward chamber. Yep, pressing a lever for little chocolate chips. Mm-hmm. It's my life. Okay, so they're not going anywhere. Okay, so how do we account for this? How do we explain this? Three interpretations to look at. The first of these, and the earliest of these to be proposed, is called the discrimination hypothesis. It's also the easiest to sort of mentally wrap your head around. Unfortunately, it also seems to be wrong, which is kind of a bummer. The suggestion here at the discrimination hypothesis is that it's just going to be easier to notice the start of extinction if you're on continuous reinforcement. Right? So if you're on an FR1, I respond, you know, I get a peanut, I respond, I get a peanut, I respond, where's my peanut? The first time you don't get something, pretty apparent. Contrast that with, for example, an FR10. I respond, I don't get anything, I respond, I don't get anything, I respond, etc., etc., etc. At some point, you get your peanut. Okay? But, you know, maybe you haven't really been counting. You know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Here comes Mr. Peanut. 10. Yay. What if you've lost count? Okay? What if you're a rat and can't count? Right? I mean, rats, it's like, okay, here we go. 1, 2, 3. More than 3. Lot more than 3. Whole bunch. I mean, that's about as good as a rat's going to do. It's just sort of an estimation process at some point. So you don't know exactly when, which means, you know, if it's like every time and then you don't get something, it's like pretty apparent. It's like, whoa, what just happened? As opposed to you're used to not getting, it's just hard to tell. It's just like, I don't get reinforced every single time. I have to make a bunch of responses. I may not know exactly how many. I don't know if I've quite gotten there yet. I can't tell if extinction has started just now or not. Okay. So the suggestion here is that it's just easier to discriminate exactly when extinction starts on a CRF. Conversely, you know, by extension, it would be harder to discriminate when extinction starts on an FR50 than an FR10. Right? And that fits with our behavioral data, right? The higher the schedule, the longer you keep responding before you extinguish. Okay, so discrimination hypothesis, it's not just about CRF versus everything else. It just says that the higher the schedule goes, the harder it is to discriminate the beginning of extinction. Okay, great. The problem with it is, this guy Jenkins in 62 demonstrated that the PRE, partial reinforcement of extinction effect, the PRE, may not be due to difficulties in actually noticing the beginning of extinction. So Jenkins had two groups of pigeons. First group is on CRF, continuous reinforcement. Second group is on a partial reinforcement schedule. After doing some training like this, he shifts them both onto a CRF schedule. Okay, so I mean, group one just stays on CRF, and group two, the one that was previously being partially reinforced, shifts over to a CRF and is now on continuous reinforcement. Every response gets reinforced. Okay, they do that for a while, and after they get some more conditioning trials, both on the CRF, immediately shifts them on to extinction. So there's no delay in there. Right? They don't have any like spontaneous recovery things or anything going on. They just, once you're done with their second batch of now CRF trials, boom, right on to extinction. bum, 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 measures how long it takes before extinction occurs in each group, finds that the second group took longer to extinguish than the first group. Now, look, they've both been on CRF. They should by now both be used to saying, hey, I get reinforced every single time. It should be really easy for both groups to go, whoa, I just didn't get reinforced that time. What's up? I think something different happened. Okay? But that's not the case. The previous exposure to the partial reinforcement means it takes longer for that group to extinguish, which means the discrimination hypothesis suggestion that you just have a problem discriminating the first extinction trial doesn't seem to work. The effects here of our partial reinforcement, PRF just stands for partial reinforcement, seem to be long-lasting. It's been suggested then that perhaps what partial reinforcement teaches you is just don't give up in the face of failure. You've done a response, you got nothing, but don't quit, keep going, because maybe another response will do it for you. It sounds like something you should have on a t-shirt or something if you're doing charity work. Frustration theory. Second one here. This one says that intermittent reinforcement, you're going to have rewarded and non-rewarded responses. So if you're on an intermittent schedule or a partial reinforcement schedule, some of your responses will lead to a reinforcer delivery. Some will lead to a non-reinforced outcome. Incidentally, we're talking about reinforcers here. We could talk about this in terms of punishers as well. It's just that most of the research is done with appetitive outcomes, so it's just the way that it's sort of gone. Because if you're using something that's aversive, right, you very quickly just stop responding altogether. Okay. So, anyways, frustration says then responses that get rewarded are motivating. Non-rewarded responses produce frustration. Now, typically, I mean, in the laboratory, we can actually really regulate this. You are on an FR6 schedule. In the real world, like, absolutely fixed schedules are pretty unusual. Even, honestly, in the laboratory, things, they're pretty unusual as well. Either because, your equipment doesn't work quite right, the lab tech forgets to turn something on or turn something off, or your subject just loses track of where they are and doesn't actually realize they're on that kind of fixed schedule. But generally, outside of psychologists messing around with this, there are relatively few things that are going to produce a perfectly consistent response to outcome pattern. So there's typically some variation in when you are going to get reinforced. Consequently, sometimes what you would expect to be a non-reinforced response, surprise, surprise, produces a reinforcer. So, you might say, okay, let's imagine that we've got a case where, the delivery of the mail, your letter carrier to your area, bam, bam, like clockwork. Okay, very consistent. You check at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, sometime between 3 o'clock and 3:10, your mail will show up. Well, for whatever reason, maybe someday your letter carrier does the route in reverse, or your letter carrier is ill, and so a different letter carrier takes the route for the day and gets there at 1:30 and delivers your mail. If you happen to be coming in, and you say, well, hey, looks like there's something in my mailbox. You check, there's something there. You were expecting it to be a non-reinforced response. There shouldn't be anything in my mailbox. I shouldn't get my mail until 3 to 3:10. It's 1:30. Look, there's something there. Okay, so in that sense, in the real world, we get cases where it's pretty common for what you would expect to not lead to reinforcement to produce a reinforcer. You phone your friend, you expect they're at work. Oh, they're actually at home. Why was that? Oh, they took a flex day or something like that. Okay, so didn't expect to be rewarded. You got it. Because of this, then, frustration theory says the frustration that gets associated with non-reinforced responses actually can lead to motivation for the expectation of reward. So the more frustrated you get, the more that's telling you, if you will, it's a little bit of a stimulus here, a little stimulus control, saying you're going to be getting reinforced pretty soon. Just the frustration means that reinforcement could happen. Now, in continuous reinforcement, you can't learn to respond when not expecting, or when expecting a non-reward, because you never have a non-reward. Okay? The lower the schedule, CRF being obviously the extreme on this, but the lower the schedule, the less experience you have with getting rewarded for perhaps times when you don't think you're going to get rewarded, responses that you don't think are going to be rewarded. You are less frustrated, if you will. In this sense, the higher the schedule, the more intermittent, the more frustration you will have, the more expectation then that you may have of hitting a non-rewarded, or pardon me, hitting a expected non-rewarded response that actually ends up giving you the reward. So you keep going. Okay. Last theory that we're going to look at. Oh, and incidentally, there's good empirical evidence for frustration, frustration theory. Okay, it's got support. Discrimination hypothesis, it's got problems. Frustration, it's got support. Okay. And sequential, the last one we're going to look at, it also has empirical support. Okay, so don't think of it as you know, a frustration versus sequential, and one's got to be right and the other doesn't. They both seem to have supporting data depending upon different situations. So it may not be a very simple, this has to be the only correct interpretation situation here. Now, sequential theory developed by Capaldi invokes memory concepts. So Capaldi took a little break. Capaldi was much more cognitively driven than, say, earlier comparative psychologists. I mean, people like Skinner and whatnot really didn't like talking much about what kind of cognitive stuff is going on inside a pigeon's brain. Lashley didn't, Tolman. So they didn't really like thinking about that very much because they couldn't measure it. But cognitive psychology kind of comes in a big way in the late 60s and the 70s, and we've got Capaldi who's been keeping up with that. Even though he's in the learning behavior side of things, just like people like Staden and Semmelhag, the sort of new wave of comparative psychologists who eventually sort of turned into the comparative cognicists, is much more open to the idea of talking about memory systems that are going to be coming in and being involved. He doesn't try to break everything just down into stimulus control situations. So he says, these memory concepts. He says, you can remember whether or not a response from the recent past was reinforced or not. So within at least recent events, you're able to keep track. Your brain just keeps track. And again, he was a little vague on exactly how that was going to happen, because that wasn't really his point. But he says, imagine, let's say you can manage to recall whether or not, you know, a recent response was reinforced or not. On partial reinforcement training, then, intermittent reinforcement training, non-reinforced responses become, if you will, a discriminative stimulus for performing the response to get reinforced. So if you make a response and you don't get reinforced, that's okay. Because on partial reinforcement, you've learned you have to make a certain number of non-reinforced responses before you're going to get reinforced. So the fact that you didn't get reinforced on a recent response, if you will, that says, yeah, don't worry. You're doing the right thing. That's a stimulus that says you just need to make another response. Make another response. Maybe, it wasn't reinforced either. That's okay. Now, it goes through Capaldi's interpretation. The sequential theory says, now, early on in conditioning, things are a bit ambiguous. You're trying to learn what's happening. You're trying to learn the schedule. So you pay a lot of attention to things like sequencing, hence sequential theory. So if we have like response followed by non-reinforced, non-reinforced response. So you get a response that's reinforced. First response is reinforced. Second response is non-reinforced. Okay. Third response is non-reinforced. You're now expecting your next one to be non-reinforced, but it isn't. It's reinforced. Oh, look at that. So that becomes an important one. It's like, oh, sometimes it's not going to just be, you know, reinforced, nothing, 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 nothing. It's like, oh, sometimes a non-reinforced gets followed by reinforced, but now, so it's like, okay, I'm expecting reinforcement. Sure enough, you get it on the next one. Oh, it's non-reinforced. Oh, okay. Oh, but look, now after only one non-reinforced trial, I get reinforced again. So early on, he says, you know, how rapidly are you going to learn? It's going to depend upon the particular sequence, but these ones that are unexpected, when you're not expecting the response to get reinforced, those are the ones that become important. With experience, you get better and better at this. With experience, what's happening is you learn to respond when remembering not having been reinforced for recent responses. So the longer you've gone without being reinforced, that just says you're getting closer and closer to getting reinforced. Sooner or later, you're going to have to hit a response that will get you reinforcement. Now, on continuous reinforcement, you don't have any expectation that you're going to have non-reinforced responses. Every response is going to be reinforced. So if you will, you have no experience with saying, oh, it's okay, non-reinforced responses, it means I just have to keep going. Because that's what actually tells me I'm getting closer to getting a reinforced response. Similarly, if you are on a low intermittent schedule, you've got less experience with non-reinforced responses leading to reinforcement. And the higher you go, the more experience you have with that. Okay. So, as I said, both frustration and sequential theory have empirical support for them. It's not a either-or situation. Last thing we're going to talk about is here is behavioral momentum. The analogy is made with Newtonian physics. So momentum equals your mass times your speed. So hence the old saw about a body in motion tends to stay in motion, and a cat asleep will tend to just lie there like a lump. Pavlov had a dog, Newton had a cat. Behavior that has a lot of momentum is going to be hard to disrupt. So changing something may not have a big effect. Just like if you've got a physical object with a lot of momentum, it's going to be hard to shift it. What was the Bruce Willis movie with the asteroid heading for the Earth? Armageddon, right, yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, so Armageddon. Best movie ever. No. Actually, pretty bad. But right, so Armageddon. We've got a giant asteroid heading straight for the Earth. Okay, and the problem is, how are we going to shift it? Because it's got all of this mass and all of this speed, and it's heading straight for the Earth. And the obvious solution is roughneck rig pigs that are going to drill into the asteroid and blow it up. Of course, that's obviously how we'd solve this problem. Sure. But this is the issue, right? You know, this is the big tension in the movie. You got to get there soon enough so the explosion, the nuclear detonation you can set off will be enough to push the asteroid a little bit off to the side so it just grazes the Earth. It just misses us. You know, passes the atmosphere. And instead, he blows it up into pieces and, you know, himself with it and showers down there. Okay, so anyways, but that's the idea of momentum. You know, if it were not a huge asteroid coming to the Earth, it's like, oh no, there's, you know, something about the size of a basketball coming towards the Earth. Let's see, what can we do? Well, we could just shoot Bruce Willis into space. Will that actually solve the problem? Well, no, but we will have just shot Bruce Willis into space, which is probably good for something. You could just show up next to the basketball-sized asteroid and, like, kick it. And seeing as it has relatively low mass, unless it was going super, super fast, we could deflect it relatively easily. We wouldn't need to drill into it and set nuclear bombs off. So this is the same idea with the behavior. A behavior that is very strong. I'm not suggesting behaviors have to have mass or speed, but here, you know, it's an analogy, right? So a behavior that is really well established, it's very strong, is going to be harder to change. Now, behavioral momentum theory is typically evaluated or studied using multiple schedules of reinforcement. So under different different contexts, different things happen. So we have two or more components, each that's got its own discriminative stimulus and reinforcement schedule. So essentially, we've got multiple three-term contingencies running in some sort of sequence there. Then what happens is you add some sort of disruption in, and you see whether or not you can disrupt the behaviors here. That's the manipulation. Okay, so the disruption could be any number of things. It could be like adding additional food between the phases of a component. So between the first schedule and the second, let's toss in some food, see what a little bit of satiation does here. It could be, let's run an extinction. Let's run a block of extinction trials. It could be, hey, let's just toss in a novel salient stimulus and see what effect we have. There's a few, a number of studies have been done using this, and some interesting results. First off, response rate. It really, not always, the majority of the studies that have been done found that response rate really isn't all that important in terms of behavioral momentum. It doesn't matter if you're responding really fast, I mean, you know, like actual physical momentum with an object, the faster the object is going, the more momentum it's got. That's where the analogy sort of breaks down. It doesn't matter if you're doing a really rapid rate of responding or a slower rate of responding. Generally, most of the work that's been done finds that that's not really what's important here. That's fairly unrelated to the behavior's resistance to modification. What's really important is the rate of reinforcement. Now, we looked at the study where the pigeons were frustrated and pecking other pigeons, and I showed you the, 1, 3, 5, 10, 30 pieces of food, okay? And we saw there that, you sort of plateau at a certain level there, but as the amount of reinforcement goes up, if you're getting more reinforcement, then you're more resistant, if you will, to extinction effects. So the higher the rate of reinforcement, either in terms of frequency of getting reinforced or amount that you get, which over the long term increases the amount of reinforcements you acquire, the higher this is, the higher the rate that produces greater momentum, hence the less susceptible high rates of reinforcement systems are to extinction. This really seems to be the most important component or element here. What this implies then is that we've got a stimulus outcome association that's regulating behavioral momentum. In the presence of the stimulus, the outcome, specifically the rate of reinforcement of your outcome, is going to be important. Consequently, doing things like adding non-contingent reinforcers to, say, one schedule on a multiple schedule can change its behavioral momentum. Now, so let's say we've got a schedule that's on, a variable ratio of 30. Subjects are responding away to get the reinforcers. Okay. Now, if we just start tossing in some non-contingent reinforcers, so we've got our VR30 schedule going, but every now and then we just toss the rat another chocolate chip. Well, that's not actually changing the rate of reinforcement of the schedule itself in terms of response to outcome. It doesn't have any effect on how your responses influence the outcome. But in the presence of this system that you're operating in, we've just boosted the outcome. So an association here isn't being made between the responses and the outcome. It's coming in between the stimulus and the outcome. In this context, sometimes you just get even more stuff. So this would be like one of these disruptions. So we just toss a little bit more food in there and see what happens. It's not influencing the RO. It affects the O, but there's no change in terms of response rate. Speeding your response rate up, slowing it down, makes no difference on those non-contingent deliveries of reinforcers. Study by Mace here. Mace and colleagues from 90. So during a baseline phase, so the open circle is a VI 60. The closed is a VI 240 second schedule. So during the baseline, and these are from two different subjects, imaginatively enough, called subject 1 and subject 2. So during baseline, you know, fairly consistent response rates here. I mean, this is the thing. With VI schedules, once you kind of cross a certain level, the V, you know, you just respond periodically. So let's see, responses per minute. So they're responding about once every 3 seconds. Okay? And, you know, whether it's a VI 60 or a VI 240, it stays about the same here. Then there's a concurrent distracting stimulus, and look what happens. This disrupts things a little bit. Then we go back to a baseline phase, and again, they're pretty similar here. Then we put in another concurrent distracting stimulus and take a look. So response rates drop in both, whether it's the VI 60 or the VI 240, but the response rate drops during this distracting stimulus less for the VI 60. VI 60 actually gives you a higher rate of reinforcement. The VI 60 has greater momentum in this sense. The VI 240, you're getting many fewer reinforcers. And so it is more susceptible to this distracting stimulus that's presented. Okay? And then we have the screen of black. Okay, so next class, people at the break were asking about this. Next class, I will be bringing the second midterm along. We'll find some time either towards the end of class there to look it over, or if we need to, we can somehow stay probably here or set up someplace else to give people a chance to see their second midterm. I will also bring the first midterm. So I was asked to bring the first midterm along, so we'll have those if people want to take a look at them too. And we'll have your papers for you as well. So we're only going to get through Chapter 10. We're not going to be able to get into Chapter 11. I was overly optimistic when I set up the schedule for the course, within having heard that I was going to teach the class 30 minutes earlier. As I said, given that this chapter didn't exist the last time I taught the course, you know, when I look back at my old notes, you know, it's overly hopeful of what we could get done there. So I'm afraid we won't get through chapter 11 after all. So sorry about that. So the final exam will only cover stuff up to chapter 10. And we'll talk about the exam more next class as well.